Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Reckless Atalk, our TTRPG interview show where we sit down with some of our favorite writers, players, GMs, and streamers to get to know a little bit more about what makes them who they are. I am, as always, your host, GM Nathan, and I am so excited to be back for our first full episode of 2024, particularly with this wonderful and, dare I say, newsworthy interview. I got to once again be a huge nerd about tabletop games and about journalism as I got to enjoy a very fun, very thought-provoking chat with co-founder of TTRPG news outlet Rascal, Rowan Zioli. Rowan is one of the biggest independent news voices in the space, with phenomenal work done particularly in the review and interview spheres. In this episode, we talk a lot about her experiences doing both for Rascal, a new independent, reader-supported, worker-owned outlet covering tabletop news and shows. But we also talk a lot about identity, creativity, the twists and turns of life, collaborative critique, and what journalism as a service means. Most interestingly and refreshingly, we talked a lot about the importance of news coverage and critical review in the tabletop and actual play world. But before I throw to the episode, I want to do a small appeal to everyone listening. I was a hyper-local journalist for many years, and I cannot stress enough how important I personally believe small outlet journalism is to the world. Please find places in your hometowns, outlets that cover things you care about, that affect you, and other people doing the work of shining a spotlight where there is darkness. And then, if you're able, pay them money so that they can keep doing what they're doing, or at least subscribe to newsletters and otherwise vote with your dollars and your clicks and your attention. As always, if you enjoy this episode, please go check out our other Reckless Atalk interviews and maybe even our actual play episodes. We have links to all the stuff that Rowan and I talk about in the episode in the show notes, including lots of links to Rowan's journalism. With that, I'll see you next time. Hello, Rowan.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you, Nathan? I'm so excited.
I am exactly the same. We are a mirror of energy, excitement, good vibes. So excited to have you here. Thank you for joining us here on Reckless Atalk.
Woo! Thank you so much for having me. I'm real excited. Actually, full circle, I think one of the first times I ever really like dove into Lynn's work was listening to your conversation with my colleague Lynn Codega. So yeah.
I'm glad that I can also now be listed as one of the co-founders of Rascal. I think that means a lot, to kind of be able to be involved in citizen journalism in such a way. But hey, Rowan, for those people who aren't familiar with you and why my impact on your life is so significant to the internet and hobby space at large, could you tell the dear listener whomst you are?
Yeah, of course. I am Rowan Zioli. I am an actual play journalist and a co-founder of Rascal, a new worker-owned, reader-supported, independent tabletop role-playing game journalism outlet. That really is a mouthful. It never gets easier to say.
You always hope it will, but that's the joys and also the drawbacks of having a nuanced approach.
Yeah, just towards, being like, hey, we're a journalism outlet doesn't really cover our whole vibe, our whole brand.
No, especially not in the year of our Lord 2024. That means quite a few different things, and very few of them mean exactly what it is that Rascal is. And listeners may already know, we talked to Lynn Codega a little while ago here on Reckless Atalk, who has gone on to be one of the co-founders with you. And I'm sure we'll be talking much more about your shared work, your shared business, all that good stuff as we go. But Rowan, that's not the format. That's not
the
tradition.
We're always breaking tradition over here at Rascal News.
I know, but we're on my turf, We're here. This is my space, and my space always starts
with coding.
I know. I was they immediately popped in my mind. It's like, can I slip in a proto social media joke? I don't think so. So I'm glad you picked up the assist. We start at the beginning is the point. And there you have multiple beginnings that we will be getting into. But, you know, we are ostensibly a tabletop role-playing game discussion podcast. And so let's start there. Do you remember, and this could be kind of a two-part answer, but when you started getting those inklings either of kind of tabletop role-playing games specifically or just the general kind of allure of nerdery and or performing?
Absolutely. This is actually new. Mm-hmm. I have not yet said out of this on any podcast.
Which is wild because this is the question that I most frequently ask, do I need to edit this out? Because it's the question everyone gets asked all the time. Is everyone's like, do you remember when you started playing D&D for the first time? But see future Nathan editing this. This is why we leave it in.
You got it, future Nathan. The nuance there, though, is in general nerdery, is I was a really big reader when I was a kid. My first like big hyperfixation was the Aragon books by Christopher Paolini.
Ooh, got
it. So those are the thing that really got me into like nerdery. I was like, oh, fantasy is very cool. And then just kind of from there, the general nerd zeitgeist that exists, you know, Star Wars, Harry Potter, rip to all of the other stuff that has occurred. And then role-playing games specifically, I'd always been a performer. I had been like the theater kid TM in high school, among many other things that I did, because as you can tell by if you look at my link tree or any of the things that I've done, I don't know how to rest. capitalism has thoroughly trained me that my value as a human is equivalent to my output and productivity. So
indeed,
if anyone takes anything away from this podcast, that should be it.
Is that your worth indeed, as we are here creating content together.
Exactly. So I was a theater kid and I really enjoyed performing. And then a friend of mine was running a 3.5 game for another friend's birthday. And from that, I was like, oh, this I can just do whatever. And that really got me.
Ooh, yep, absolutely. And did that happen to you like first session? Because that doesn't always happen for people. Is that kind of that clicking into place of like, oh, I can do literally anything. And did that like, that was present from like the get-go for you?
Yeah, I think it was because I've always been a creative writer. I had always been engaged in storytelling and in theater. And so like the idea of moving towards narrative was really important to me. I was part of a touring children's theater group when I was a kid.
Amazing. That's the first tangent that I will not be taking us down, but I'd like to note for the record that I would like to go on that tangent, but I'm staying focused.
The record, it has been noted. And so we did a lot of devised theater. We also did mime, just as another side note.
I'm saying nothing.
This engaged creativity and this collaborative creativity was kind of inherent in the work that I'd done outside of TTRPGs. And then I got to college, and I did get it the first time because the DM that I had was a really, really brilliant DM. He had been playing already at that point. He started when he was like 5. He was the only kid in our group who had like been engaged with it for a very long time. And the other people around us were kind of, I don't want to say just nerds, but they were just nerds.
There are different approaches to the game, right? And some of them are intense performer kind of approach and driving to the narrative and whatever, and others aren't. So
exactly. Yeah. Very, very, like each one has its value. Each one has its place, but I was gonna have my time. And so the DM was also really happy and excited about this, cause that's also the type of story that he enjoys engaging with. And so from there, it just kind of launched and I was like, oh, this is incredible. I went off to college, you know, the taboo around nerdery that only started to break around like 2015, 2016, I was just graduating high school at that point. So I was still like deep in the pits of like, I can't like anything. Liking things is bad. And so then I got to college, started playing a little bit there with some people who are already there, and then got kicked out of college for allegedly having herbal pharmaceuticals in my room. Allegedly, of course.
Allegedly. The cases are still ongoing. There's an extensive appeal process. And that's not what this podcast is about, other than sounds like bullshit. I don't know.
Say, sounds like some bullshit.
That's the only official stance that we'll be taking on the matter. But yikes. That sounds very stressful.
It was not great, but I'm very fortunate to be very privileged and have a very supporting, loving family. And so I was able to go back home and live with my parents after that and like kind of work full time. And then my friends who I had played D&D with that first time were still at home. And so I was like, oh, I can run a game for everyone. And so from there, I started being like, oh, I get to be the one to tell this story and like engage this world with the mm-hmm. other players. And this is something actually very cool that just happened. Dungeon Master's Block, another podcast in the ecosystem, yep. does some really cool, incredible work, has been around for a very long time.
Very familiar.
They were like a very big pillar of why I started running games, how I learned how to run games, mm-hmm. kind of ethos of like being a good person and not like a shitty grognard about D&D.
Yep.
And yeah. They just followed me on Twitter the other day. And I was like, this is so full circle. This is a beautiful moment.
It's truly wild when that happened. Like, yep, I'm not too ever starstruck, but it has not gotten old yet.
It's just
either.
Like, it's so beautiful to see the work matters in ways that you will never be mm-hmm. able to know. And so that's really yep. important to
Definitely.
Me. But from there, I started running a lot of games. And then I got into a bunch of other games. I like branched out from D&D, started playing like Shadowrun, Call of Cthulhu. Real easy games to jump into after D&D.
Yep.
And from there, it was just like, oh, this is a part of my life. I was watching actual play. I started watching Critical Role in like 2015, really soon after they started. And so I got on the actual play bandwagon pretty early from there. But it was like, again, I didn't really talk about actual play to anyone. I would like watch it in my room with the mm-hmm. volume turned down, being like, what are people going to think is happening? What are they going to think that I'm watching? And then I met my partner, Max Gross, who is a stand-up comedian, really incredible. Go follow him on the internet. I always have to plug him whenever I talk about him because, God, I love him.
We will put links in the show notes. Yep.
But he was the first person who I like shared actual play with. I was like, hey, I'm going to show you a real niche video of Brennan Lee Mulligan yep. as Tony the Tiger playing a serial-based TTRPG that is just chaos.
Yep. And isn't that the true sign of like vulnerability? Is like, hey, I have a weird video to show you.
That's love.
And is it unlike what more archetypical bridge is there in a relationship in this day and age? I can't think of any.
Exactly. And so then he got into it. I started showing him Dimension 20, and now he loves actual play. And from there, we'll circle back because I feel like we're gonna have to do a little like coda to go back to where journalism started.
Well, yeah, 100%. I trust your story organization instincts. Yeah.
But then from there, after all that, I'd already been a journalist. I saw Dungeons and Drag Queens, was like, oh, a lot of my writing had already been about queerness. And I was like, this is a perfect intersection of queerness and niche culture and how where I was introduced to TTRPGs, again, was like grognardy people who mm-hmm. it's a very exclusionary single demographic. That at the time I fell into and then no longer did. And was like, hey, D&D is for everyone. And then from there, writing about it critically, fell down this rabbit hole so hard.
Yep. So this became, it sounds like, a pretty big, I mean, as much as you were socially allowing yourself for it to be, obviously like a pretty big part of your kind of self-expression and of your hobbies and of things that you shared with other people and ways you spent your time. So for you, and again, this could be playing, this could be watching, this could be all of the above, but what about kind of the performative act, especially in the construct of tabletop role-playing games? Like what has kept your attention since high school, you know, and kind of through all the different stages of your personal and professional life?
Not to get like too woo-woo about it.
That's the show.
Yeah.
That's the what we want.
That's what we're here for. I think storytelling is magic. Point blank, end of sentence. Like whatever you think magic is, the feeling that storytelling, the true immersive, like brain neuron firing narrative transport that occurs when you are listening to and engaging and creating a story is magic. And there's no other experience I've had that captures that feeling. Like, I have done theater, and like, that ego is kind of there at the forefront. You don't necessarily get to dissolve yourself because you're like, oh no, I am doing this in front of a bunch of people, which actual play then gets into. But the like, oh, I am in a safe container with people that I ideally love and trust, where I can explore these things. In theater, I had always been cast as like the man in drag roles. And so whenever I had to explore femininity, it was always as a joke. It was always kitsch. And then playing D&D, I got to embody these characters and have it just be, and not have it be a joke, not have it be another gag. And so that's just one example of like the ways that my worldview has been altered simply by immersing myself in a collaborative storytelling environment.
Something that is interesting for me, again, as I've said on here before, I used to be a reporter and have also been playing, you know, D&D and tabletop stuff for a long time. And for me, they were always kind of the intersection of those was always interesting for me to just kind of think about where, how they are similar and how they are drastically, like, unpenetrably different. And so for you, when did journalism kind of start come into your life, I guess? And especially right now in the kind of the current climate of journalism, what kept you going through what I assume was a lot of pain in the ass?
Yeah. Well, I graduated college into the quarantine of pandemic. My last semester of college was quarantined. It was when it started.
Great, yeah. Grant, fun.
And I was going to school for creative writing because I don't make smart decisions.
You're talking to a history major. So like, yep.
We're here, we're in solidarity. And so from there, I was like, okay, well, what do I do with this now? I founded a nonprofit organization called Write Hive, which is an annual convention that hosts free events and workshops and panels and hosts awards and gives out grants. A fantastic organization that is still doing some really, really great work. I had to step away about 2 years in because it was entirely volunteer based and I was a college student and I could not be CEO of a company. It was just wild. It was a wild situation for me to be in. The people who are there are much better equipped to actually do that kind of work. But from there, I started doing freelance book editing. And so I was a ghostwriter. I had gotten into editing books and novels and memoirs. And that started drying up as like the economy shifted and people weren't able to independently pay for freelance editing. And so I kept doing that sporadically. I had also at the same time been doing stand-up comedy. I had taken a little like Amtrak. What's the book? I can't remember. The book where he goes around the country, Beatnik, I can't remember his name. On the Road. Oh. Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
Yep, got it.
Had my own little experience where I went around on an Amtrak train and met a lot of really interesting people, went to a comedy show, saw a queer comic and went, oh, they're really bad at this. I could do that.
A well-known phenomenon, I think, for anyone watching anyone do anything.
Quite literally. I was like, oh, that seems easy. It was not easy. but I did that, got a little bit viral from that, posted some TikToks that really popped off, got some success there. And then from there, someone started wanting to hire me to do comedy journalism. That's where it all ties back. And so I started doing comedy journalism. I reported on my friend, Lucas Arnold, who had a show at the Edinburgh Fringe. I did interviews with like, what is it like being a comedian? What are some tips? Kind of SEO driven content automation stuff. And then started writing for this company called Tripsitter, which is a psychedelic publication. And I wrote about psychedelics and gender identity for them. And then kind of veered off down that and did a deep dive investigation into a widespread phenomenon where people reporting their ADHD medication was no longer being as effective as it was. Broke that story with a nothing publication. Only like me and the New York Times had written about it. And it was very crazy and weird. And went down that rabbit hole and then was like, this is killing my soul. I don't have the financial institutional support to do this kind of genuine reporting that needs to be done.
Yep. Yep.
And then I saw Dungeons and Drag Queens and was like, oh, I can write about this. And then that popped off. And I was like, oh, I'd always felt like the writing that I was doing was really important for like the education, especially writing about queerness and like the importance of queer history. And then the realization of like, oh, this like radical queer joy that is present in this show. The response that I got to posting that article was so many people being like, this is the first time I'm encountering D&D and I love it so much. And I was like, wait, why is this a disconnect in the community? Why is this so underrepresented? And it's not. There are so many queer people doing so much work in the TTRPG industry, but there's no journalism about it. And that's where I was like, oh, here, I can like use the skills that I have developed and this like relentless drive that I have to really tangibly benefit a specific community of people who are trying to make art. And I think the thing about the TTRPG community that really drew me also was the TTRPG community is so progressive and is so radical in so many of the ways that it tries to organize itself and the ideals that it presents. And we still got a lot to fix, just as any leftist little group does. But because of the like imaginative power that I was just talking about, like you can imagine new worlds, you can imagine new things, you can create whatever you want to create and model that within a TTRPG or an actual play. And being able to like show that there are people who are doing this and get more eyes on that so more people can be affected by their art and they can get paid and sustain themselves to make this art. I was like, oh, this is where I can help. Like, this is what I can do to tangibly impact a community.
That's very interesting, especially because it sounds like you have largely been a, I guess niche reporter is a fine phrase. It sounds diminutive, but yeah. I don't mean it that way. But just in terms of a lot of very yeah. specific topics has been a big part of kind of your reporting career. And then to now find yourself again being very niche and even like niche within niche is that it's not just, you know, that I know that we'll get into this later, but I know that Rascal is not just like, cool, we're reprinting press releases mm-hmm. or we are covering just the big guys or we're doing whatever. It's very fascinating to me, at least, that was always, it seems like always kind of a like a black hole in a direction that was kind of catching you in its gravity. Is that something that you are like consciously kind of trying to keep in mind at all times, like trying to kind of have that mission driven life and creative approach and work approach and that sort of thing? Or is it just like it kept working out where I found stuff that I really cared about and that's nice?
Both, for sure, both, 100%. Mm-hmm. But I have a really like deep fundamental belief that there is universal in the specific, that like we exist in a microcosm, everything is intrinsically connected. And what is happening in the niche, what is happening in the fringes, is much more reflective of what is happening at the core than what people think is happening. You can see how people's lives are tangibly impacted and effective by reporting on psychedelics and harm reduction. You can see, like, I hosted the Tripsitter podcast where I spoke to a lot of really incredible people at the fringes of their industries. One person that, like, the conversation that has always stuck out to me among many things is one of them, we spoke with a guerrilla harm reduction organization working down in Nashville who would do drug testing and who would do wound care and who would give out free paraphernalia, for lack of a better term, but very much actively being like, oh, this is a niche that no one is thinking about because the core has put out this idea of propaganda of the drug war and who is actually being impacted by that. And while it's not as life or death in the TTRPG industry, the thing that I've really leaned into with focusing on the niche of art and culture, in my article that I put out with Zoe Zephyr and Aaron Reed had this really beautiful statement where culture reporting and culture journalism is so important because it shows that people are people. And the empathy that is curated and crafted and fostered when you can recognize that someone who ostensibly looks and acts and is interested in very different things than you are, still has that shared humanity, or makes a game that you really, really like, or does all of these things that you would never think of because you're so distracted by the everything of it all. That's where culture journalism can bring things together and be like, hey, you weren't thinking about this. Pay attention to this, and this is why it matters.
And I know that Rascal is new, but you also have been doing games stuff previously. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like in some ways we're talking around Rascal, but we'll get to it. I'm not worried about it. But are you enjoying the focus of it, I guess? In terms of the, I am covering TTRPGs, which is diverse and has a lot of aspects to it and a lot of size, you know, in all directions and product types and whatever. Is that something that you enjoy? You're kind of in your work is kind of having a thing and that being the thing you are just driving into and trying to know as much as possible and trying to get your arms around as much as you can? Or is this just like, hey, this is the opportunity that's in front of me, and so therefore I'm going to have a great time with it?
Maybe not forever. Maybe once we have the foundation sure. a little bit grounded, I'll feel a little bit more comfortable to like pitch out to other things about some other ideas that I have, because my brain is definitely in a lot of different areas. But for right now, yeah, absolutely. I get so much joy from talking about this and the people that I get to talk to and the brilliant minds that go into creating this art. The thing that I feel very privileged to do is I get to talk to people who put so much intention and thought into the work that they do and never get to talk about it because there's no discoverability in our medium. But in getting to talk about those very specific things, I get to talk about everything. Like, I got to talk about like politics and journalism and activism with Aaron Reed and Zoe. I got to talk about the role of journalism in oppressing communities and the way tokenism and the way racial dynamics are really implicated in the TTRPG system with the cast of Harlem Hellfighters Never Die. And so the next article I have coming out is this piece where I spoke to an Argentinian journalist, and I got to talk about like how this is a big report coming out Friday probably, but how there was an issue with an ambassadorship program down in South America and how that community is thriving and existent, but does not get the attention of the larger English-speaking world because of an artificial language barrier and because the West hegemony of everything really centers a very specific kind of person in the work that they put out. And so really digging into these topics that talk about things that are not just impacting our community is where I find so much joy of being like, hey, this shit is so important everywhere else. We just happen to be here.
I'm trying to figure out how best to phrase the question. Mm. So you spoke to culture being a worthwhile yeah. thing to talk about, especially in fringe culture, especially, you know, to as a way to look at everything. Is there something about TTRPG reporting as a subject that you think is, I don't know if particularly worthy is right, but is kind of why that scene needs to be talked about and needs to have those kind of spotlights put upon it? Maybe not more than other communities or spaces, but maybe just as much as other communities and spaces. Why that community you feel like, obviously, is something that needs professional journalism in it.
Yeah. I think the reason being that it's all so new.
Yeah.
Other forms of culture journalism deal with established mediums that have been around for decades, hundreds, thousands of years. They have had really solid ways to ingratiate themselves within the fabric of society. So they bring a lot of joy and a lot of culture and a lot of art and still get to talk about these social problems. But in doing so, have fallen victim to becoming part of the systems that they are critiquing. What TTRPGs are doing right now, despite the fact that we have, yeah, mega corporations and we all still exist under capitalism, the indie TTRPG community and the indie actual play community don't exist outside of capitalism because we are also subjected to it. But we have the potential and opportunity to do something else. we have the opportunity to create structures on such a small, inconsequential scale that we can try out things and we can explore new ways of being and new ways of being in community and new ways of talking and new ways of handling money and dividing labor and minimizing exploitation, if not like eradicating it. That can all happen within the context of a niche community in ways that it can't in television or film. Mm-hmm. And so reporting on the ways those experiments are going and getting to share that and getting to critique that and getting to go, okay, well, if we're collectively imagining a new future, what does that look like in practice? That's why I think TTRPGs are so important.
And now, a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by A Foul Light Shines, a new free serial novel based on a D&D campaign. The Empire of Fire and Water has known 20 golden years of peace since the end of Agenion's War, a peace which is now in peril. When a ragtag group of friends intervene in a grotesque monster attack, they're too late to save a wounded man who leaves them with an encrypted journal and the words, "Trust no one, Tyr." Can the gang find Tyr, escape the claws of more strange monsters, and uncover the lurking threat to the Empire before it's too late? This story features themes of found family and strength in diversity, and is available for free on Campfire and Royal Road. A Foul Light Shines. Come for the fantasy. Stay for the cheese-obsessed goblin gunslinger.
Hi, it's me, Sophie. Do you want more Reckless Attack? Then join our Discord and chat with us in our community. The link for the Discord is in the show notes, or head on over to our website, recklessattack.com. We also have a Patreon. You can listen to our new show, Reckless Snack, and other content if you become a patron. We really appreciate your support, and thank you for listening to the episode.
Something that, and I think this will be a good transition again to actually talk about Rascal at some point directly, but I noticed in that description and a couple other times that you've used the phrase "we," you know, in referring to those who care about tabletop role playing games and make them or enjoy consuming them or whatever. And something that I know I always struggled a lot with as a reporter, and something that Lynn and I talked a lot about, was that dichotomy of being a reporter in and around a space or community, and the amount of access that you need, and therefore the amount of connections you have to make, the amount of being a part of a community you have to do to know what's happening, to know who's who, to know all that kind of stuff. But also the responsibility of keeping yourself just apart enough that you can report on things, not impassively, but report on things that are newsworthy, whatever you deem that to be, without playing favorites, without having to pull punches, without having to whatever. So how do you personally, at least, feel about navigating that balance of, it's something you love, that you as a human being like making this kind of art. You like the kind of art that you're talking about. And again, you have to be there. You're on podcasts talking about this kind of art. And yet there is that distance and there is that kind of responsibility to it. So yeah, how do you feel about it? How do you navigate it?
I am pretty open and on the record about being a recovering people pleaser.
What? Couldn't be me. What?
And so that definitely, it is a huge experiment in that, and
sure,
sort of exposure therapy in that way, because I care about the work that I do and I care about the longevity of the community that we exist within, the art forms that we talk about. I care about that a lot. I have enough faith within myself to be aware of my biases when I'm reporting on things. I also have enough faith in myself to center compassion, because I think that's where the problem lies in a lot of reporting that is critical, I suppose. There we go. I was trying to figure out the word. I was really trying to find the right word there.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Because, yes, things need to be talked about. Things need to be analyzed, and things need to really deconstruct whether this is helping or harming people, whether, like, there's this idea of, like, the film critic who just, like, bashes everything, or the theater critic who's like, this was the worst play that's ever been put up. Mm-hmm. Like, that's just feeding ego. That's not what I'm here to do. I am here to uplift people who are doing good work. I am here to hold corporations accountable. I am here to hold bad actors accountable. The people within corporations get to make their own choices, and if they make those choices that are harmful to other people, then I will talk about that without disparaging the morality of that person, unless they do something particularly heinous. But I always want to just, in that kind of reporting, bring forward the truth, and then in the editorial subjective reporting, bring forward the community.
Yeah. Yeah. And I definitely want to kind of circle back to that point as we're talking about critique, especially in the tabletop space, which is you've said a lot of really wonderful stuff about it. And there's a lot of really cool conversations happening around that right now, I feel like. But I think now is a great time to talk about Rascal and to talk about kind of how you guys are doing all those things that we have just talked about for the first, you know, 20 minutes or whatever of this interview. And so can you just, in your own words, talk a little bit about what Rascal is and about kind of its main, its thesis, I suppose?
Yeah. Rascal is a crazy new experiment, following in the tradition of some other worker-owned newsrooms like Defector and Aftermath and 404 Media. And a bunch of other ones, but not too many other ones.
Not enough.
Yeah, not enough. But it does feel like a wave is happening. Lynn, as many people know, was laid off from IO9 after doing all of the incredible reporting that they had done last year. The literally industry-shaping reporting that they had done. And I had had my own issues that I cannot legally speak to with some tabletop reporting that I had done in the past. And had never been anything other than a freelance worker ever in my life. And Chase is currently working with Dicebreaker. He's doing some incredible work there. But all of us kind of have seen the writing on the wall that the way technology is influencing the shape of the internet, the way AI is shaping SEO, the way ad revenue is shaping editorial, that's not going to be a viable model for actual journalism that isn't just marketing. And Lynn called me and was like, hey, do you want to do this? And I was like, yeah, sure. What else do I have to do? and especially because of my work with WriteHive, I have a pretty solid understanding of working with startups and how that all goes. But we really want to make sure with Rascal that we are doing journalism as a service and that the people who are supporting us can trust us that that is our intention with it. And also value the work that we are doing enough to help us survive. And I think that's true of any journalism. Yeah,
for sure. Something that I think is important to kind of hone in on is when you say journalism as a service.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that mean, I guess?
Yeah. Journalism. I know we all love the term checks and balances as it does not get instituted in our general politics. But journalism is a really essential part of any healthy social ecosystem because it is intended as an objective observer and witness to what is happening in the world. And whether it is witnessing good things and uplifting those good things and inspiring hope and drawing attention to people who deserve attention for the right reasons. And then on the other side, drawing attention to things for people who deserve attention for the wrong reasons. And as a service of people are being harmed, things are happening that is detrimental to either an individual or a group of individuals or our society at large. Journalism as a service focuses not on the ego of the person writing, but on the community that is being written about.
Yeah, love that. Something that Lynn, I know, talked about a lot when they were here, and I know I've seen you talk about, and I know seems like pretty central to what you guys are doing at Rascal, is journalism as a service is not just, you know, kind of regurgitating press releases, mm-hmm. is not just kind of limiting coverage to the things that will drive the most traffic. So I guess kind of first of all, why was that important for you guys? Why was that something that I think you've even built into like the mission statement and to the, you know, kind of the ethics part of it and have really baked into the fabric of the public facing part of the business. So why was that something that you felt was needed?
Because we needed to do something new because the old way wasn't working. We really, really care about making sure that Rascal, as it exists, serves as a foundation moving forward that cannot be altered to the whims of SEO or advertising. Because in the experiences we've had in the past, like you were saying before, we only get to write about the big names. We only get to write about Critical Role, Dimension 20, Dungeons & Dragons, anything else kind of...
Yeah, the corporations that are multi-million dollar corporations, exactly. For sure.
And there's so much more happening besides that. But if we were beholden to someone other than the community, their objectives would not align with our objectives. The objectives of SEO and the objectives of advertisers is to make money. Mm-hmm. And we are not a nonprofit, but we're not in this for profit. Mm-hmm. And so making sure that we get to hold firm our ideals moving forward of, this is what's important, not just to us, but to the community. The community is reflecting back to us that this is what is important to them. And so that's what we're going to report on. We want to make sure that even, fingers crossed that Rascal makes it that long, mm-hmm. that even long past when it's just the three of us, that those ideals never get compromised.
Yeah, definitely. Something that I think is also very interesting as part of it is your guys's embracing of tone, mm-hmm. of individual tone and voice and perspective. You know, I think a lot of people are have the idea or are stuck on the kind of non-biased, totally neutral reporter kind of vibe, right? Where I am taking information and I am regurgitating information and there are no biases here and there's no way that I am compromised by anything.
This is a non-visual medium.
Right, right, exactly. No and you guys have quite a lot of snark. You guys are indeed little rascals, non-infrequently in some of your reporting, not in a way that diminishes the quality of the reporting. But as you guys were kind of putting this together, and I know that you three are co-owners, mm-hmm. Co-bosses, co-everything. But why was that kind of a part of the philosophy as you guys were going in to not just embrace that, but to very consciously, again, bake that into the website itself?
Yeah, well, Lynn and Chase are incredible writers. Like, if you have seen anything that they have written, if you have encountered any of their work in the past, you know how good it is. They have such incredible minds, and the way that they approach things and the way that they think about this industry aligns with a lot of the things that I've been saying, but they also bring so much perspective that I simply do not have. And the reason why we lean into voicey journalism is, one, that's what people want to read. People don't want to read a regurgitated press release. People don't want to read boring nonfiction facts stated in bullet point formation. They don't want to read the SEO AI generated. Here is the answer to how to cook a chicken. I wrote so many of those articles. But that's a huge reason why, is because that's what people want to read. But then also, you can't hide your biases, like the air quotes. You can't hide your biases. Everyone is human. Everyone is coming into this with a subjective experience and is going to report on things subjectively. What you choose to report on is reflective of your biases inherently, because that's wherever your attention drawn is, a perspective, is a vantage point. And working from that understanding of why try to pretend that we don't have biases, because ultimately that just becomes harmful. Then you get places like the New York Times, which say that they are non-biased, that they are objective reporters, but then are leaning so heavily into conservative talking points and are giving space to certain people and not others, and are presenting it as objective fact. And because they've presented themselves as a non-biased resource, people who don't know any better, people who are not as media literate, people who don't have the energy or time because capitalism drains them down and they have to work constantly. So like, okay, what does the news say? And then screams at the headlines and then puts the newspaper down. We can't do that. We are going to bring our opinions to this. And I think respectability politics is just another way of oppressing people.
Yeah, for sure.
And so making sure that we're coming at this honestly, and our editorials, our op-eds are much more voicey than our like investigative reporting pieces, where we know to pull that back, where we know to report on that honestly and factually and have a position, but not overload that with bias of really weighing the scales, because that is when you present an investigation, that is the audience's decision to make based on the facts that they've been given. But yeah, without that voice, people read the work that me, Lynn, and Chase do because it's us, because of the writing that we do. And to give people the space to be authentic in the things that they want to say can only create better work.
Yeah. And this is a bit of a jumping off point, I think, for the next segment of the conversation about what Rascal does and why. But how is it organized behind the scenes? You know, and we've kind of alluded to it already of co-bosses and co-founders and co-everythings. But yeah, how is it structured? And I'm curious about that just because I'm a big old fucking nerd, but also because I'm curious about how that impacts how you guys navigate reporting on news, deciding what's newsworthy, injecting that perspective or taking back the perspective, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, what does it look like? What's your guys's working relationship? What's your guys's, kind of working structure?
Yeah. So we have a non-hierarchical power structure, which, to take the theory big words out of it, means that all of us have equal say in what happens. We don't make decisions without each other. We bring everything to a vote and we talk about it pretty thoroughly. We get to a consensus and go, okay, we all agree and think this is the best way forward. We don't have a democracy per se, because we don't really think two votes outweigh one. We want to make sure that everyone's happy because we are all equal partners in this. For the literal foundation of it, Lynn's organizational mind is something that I cannot fathom. The Notion page that Lynn has made, such a blessing. Truly such a blessing. If you have ADHD and you can get into partnership with someone who has autism and you two can work together like that, kismet, blessings. The neurodivergences are so complementary. But the way that we make these decisions about what to cover, we have weekly pitch meetings every Monday. We bring forward like, hey, here's what we want to talk about. How do we feel about these things? Do we feel like we have a diversity of coverage, both about like what it is we're talking about and the people that we're talking about? Are we making sure that the stories that we're talking about are actually newsworthy, or are we just interested in them? Because, oh boy, yeah, is it easy to just fall down a rabbit hole of something that does not matter. And so having that checks and balances again between us to be like, okay, is this for us? Is this cathartic, or is it service journalism? Are we making sure that we're representing the community? For anyone going into creating a non-hierarchical power structure, it is a lot of talking. It is a lot of emotions. A big thing that we're doing, especially being a three-person company, is we are really prioritizing making sure that each of us are taking care of ourselves.
Yeah.
Because it is so easy to just keep going until you collapse. And making sure that we are checking in on each other, being like, hey, we said we were going to get off at 6 p.m. tonight. It is 7:15. What are you doing here? Or, hey, it's the weekend. We should not talk in our Discord chat. Making sure that we're actually taking the space to take care of ourselves to make this sustainable. Because sustainability long term is how we're going to make sure that Rascal is not just like an isolated event and a blip in the ecosystem.
That's always something I really love talking to creators about, is the collaboration process, especially when it comes to removing ego and trying to keep your eye on the prize, which is the service, is, you know, kind of meeting the goal, air quotes, but also of doing it in a way that everyone's happy with, that everyone feels at least a degree of good about, and is sustainable. And is that something that you are that you are, as of right now, well-equipped for? Is that something you had to learn? Is that, you know, kind of how do you navigate the kind of, at least in terms of American capitalistic culture, very antithetical kind of approach of we are all equals. Everyone has exactly the same amount of say. And we have to try and navigate feelings and working preferences and styles and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, is that something that was it comes naturally to you, something you have to work on and something you have a good perspective on?
Yeah, I guess. For me personally, it is something that I've had to do a lot of work on, not in terms of within Rascal specifically, but within my life in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have always been a very driven person. I've always been the kind of person that does things of my own volition. And learning to take criticism was something I did long ago because, especially like as an editor or as a performer or as an artist, you're going to be criticized constantly. And being able to take that criticism, hold space for it, listen to what is valid about it, listen to what is coming from a projection from the other person, internalizing that and then letting it go is such an important element of the process of collaboration. And I, specifically within the context of Rascal, am working with two people who have been doing this for a lot longer than I have, are doing this for people who've been working at Breaking News Desk for a very long time and are teaching me new skills quite literally every single day. And it is such an honor to just get to learn every single day. It is terrifying and ego-destroying and anxiety-inducing, but knowing that I'm getting better every day in this really tangible way is an experience that I am so grateful for. Learning how to take care of myself and learning how to, like, rest? Oh, that's a work in progress.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it is, I think, for everyone, I'd imagine. Do you have any... calling them tips also feels very diminutive or very clickbait SEO listicle, which is not my intent.
Listen, I'm not above a listicle. We have an article coming out tomorrow, I think, that's like 5 Zine Quest games that would make great actual plays.
Yep. I love a list. Like, I'm not going to lie. But especially as you say, as someone who is presumably taking critique frequently, at least internally, and with people that you clearly respect and people you care about and whose opinions you value, do you have a good process for kind of implementing those sorts of changes? And again, I think that's something I'm always curious about, and I think applies to anyone who might be listening to this, but also for actual play stuff and for tabletop stuff. Anytime you are working with another person who may or may not have opinions about what it is that you are doing, you know, how do you give feedback and how do you like to be given feedback, I guess? And kind of what's the process for moving through the kind of like criticism cycle that you just kind of described?
Yeah, so there are three elements to that, I think. It is, how do I give feedback? How do I get feedback? And what are some, like, what is the, like, philosophy, I guess, behind that?
Mm, yeah.
How do I give feedback? I learned really, really well from being a book editor. Being a book editor, especially for freelance indie books, you can very easily destroy someone's whole life. Mm-hmm. You can really, someone has worked for a very long time on a piece of art that they are being vulnerable enough to give you and pay you money to tear it apart and tell you how to make it better. That is such a privilege and such a gift. And someone asking you for advice is always the first step. Someone asking you for feedback is always the first step before giving it, because no one likes unsolicited feedback. And so after getting asked, making sure that you are looking at the piece of art, not as what you think it should be, but what is what you think the artist is trying to do with it, and seeing if the things that they are doing technically within their craft, within the final product, is reflecting the intention that they are putting into the art and what they want people to take away from it. If those two things are not aligned, that's where criticism should come in. In receiving criticism, it really is that process of discernment, of knowing good faith criticism from bad faith criticism, knowing how to communicate with the person who gave it to you in a way that is respectful if the criticism was given to you respectfully, and if it was not given to you respectfully, knowing to disengage with it. But receiving it, listening to it, if you can't be appreciative because it is really difficult and hard, being grateful for the opportunity to grow as an artist is what the focus should be on, because it's never about you personally. It's never about you are a bad person because you made bad art. It's always, hey, you made something and you should get to improve. I know that you have the capability of doing something better, and here is where I think you could do better. The philosophy that underlies all of that for me, this is something I have been thinking about so much and extends way beyond artistic criticism and just exists of being in community. And this is, again, going to be a lot of theory words that I'm going to try and like break down after, is knowing where to direct your anger is praxis. Knowing where you are angry, what you are angry at, and why you are angry is the first step to being a good community member. Because if you are always acting from a place of reaction and directing those emotions wildly, people are going to get hurt, no matter what side of the giving or getting criticism or just being in community aspect of it. And so being self-aware enough to know that you have received something, that you have a feeling about the thing that you have received, knowing why you are having that feeling. We love intellectualizing our feelings here.
I fit right in. Great. Look at it's the Reckless to Talk experience too.
Exactly. But being able to be like, okay, is this person a bad person for the thing that just happened? Or is the reason why this thing just happened something that goes beyond them individually? And this is so loosely tangentially connected, but I think it's the same underlying principle. People are so angry at each other all the time for things that don't matter. There is so much to be angry about that does matter. There are so many things going on in the world that you should be righteously angry about. And the anger that you are feeling almost always, and this is from personal experience, when you are angry and upset at an individual for a perceived harm, a lot of the times it is because you feel helpless in the face of systemic factors. And when you can understand that those systemic factors are influencing the way you treat people in your day-to-day life, you can realize that maybe you should be working alongside those people to change the systemic factors instead of trying to change the people that you are with. Because I think so largely, especially in the TTRPG community, but any leftist, any activist community, almost always we are all on the same side, and fighting each other is exactly what other people want us to do, because if we're too busy fighting each other, we cannot fight them.
Yeah, I think well put. And I think that translates nicely, at least for me, into a lot of the really interesting discussions that I know you and many others in the community have been, or in the space rather, have been having around criticism
yes.
of art. And I mean that in terms of critiquing as opposed to saying this sucks. And it's something certainly for me as an anxious, insecure creator myself who is doing art, but it's been really interesting to listen to people like you kind of talk about it, especially now that you have a place like Rascal where there is space to do that. And where you're not just, again, you're not just kind of covering what will drive advertising and whatever. So I guess I first want to go a little bit big picture, especially now that we've just kind of talked about a lot of the criticism part of it, but specifically referring to tabletop role-playing games, where we've already talked a little bit about how it's such a developing space. It's still so new. There are, you know, whatever, maybe triple digits people doing it even semi-professionally. And it is filled to the brim of people who are doing it at best as a side gig, or just people doing it for fun. So the question that I'm going to start with after that long preamble is, what do you think the value of critique and being a critic in the, you know, kind of the rating, I guess, or whatever, or analysis sense? What does that bring to a space like tabletop role-playing games that is, again, so new, so splintered, so diverse, so and so much art and so much personal preference? So can you start a little bit with the inherent quality of doing so?
I think criticism is really important, especially in a space like TTRPGs, because it lets people take themselves seriously. it lets people realize that what they are doing is more than just fun. Because, yeah, making art is really fun, and making art is, like, fundamental to being a human, and it is one of the reasons for being alive.
Right.
We exist in this world, though, where art says things, where art comments on society, where art has really defined aesthetic qualities that differentiates a sitcom from an hour-long drama from a feature film.
Yes.
Actual play in TTRPGs don't really have that yet. They have Critical Role. They have Dimension 20.
Yeah.
And that's the binary of actual play.
Are you, would you say you're an adventure zone, or were you more of a Critical Role kind of style thing? And that's about it. Is there anything? No, I don't think so.
I don't think there's nothing else. Exactly. And so, like, that does such a disservice to so many people making such incredible art in the community. And I am only one person, but I am one more than zero.
Yep. Yes. It's a notable increase.
And there are a lot of other people trying to do this work unsupported as little avenues in addition to their ad revenues, SEO-driven, algorithm-driven work that they're trying to do.
Yeah.
But there has not been a centralized place for criticism of TTRPGs and actual plays in the way that Rascal wants to do them. The perspectives that Lynn and Chase bring to TTRPGs and the art that is the written book of TTRPGs is incredible, is something that I do not have the skill of because I am not as versed in the indie scene, but I am very versed in the actual play scene. And so someone who has the time, financial ability, and care to be able to look at the wide breadth of all the various things being made and go, here's what connects all of them. Here's people who are making interesting things, pushing the form forward. Here's people who are trying an experiment and it didn't really work out. And here's a strange collective theme that keeps popping up over and over again in all these different shows.
Yeah.
You don't get that without criticism. You don't get Pitchfork, rip Pitchfork. You don't get that kind of musical analysis without people who are dedicated to thinking about, why does this art matter? What does this art say about the rest of the art? And what does this art say about us?
So for you, And this is, again, probably just this question is coming from me as someone who is making things, right? And trying desperately, please, someone pay attention to me, but not in nice ways, in only good ways, and only positive, you know, positive ways. You already said it, right? Of art, creation of art in and of itself is a moral positive, mm-hmm. You know, assuming harm is not being done in the creation of said art, but the creation of it is just a human good. Where's the line of asking for criticism, like you also said? And how do you navigate the complexities of it'd be one thing if these were all Hollywood studio productions, right? Mm-hmm. And all of them are companies and all of them are whatevers. But that's drastically not the case. Most places are 0% of the Critical Role budget, let alone 1% or 10% of it. Do you have a philosophy developed on that or a perspective? Or, just how do you go about it?
Yeah, so I definitely differentiate based on corporation. I will treat a corporation vastly different than I will treat a individual creator or an indie troupe. If I am critiquing a corporation's production, you can see two examples of this on Rascal right now. There is the Faster Purple Worm review, and there is the Marvel Multiverse TTRPG review.
Yep, I just reread that review this morning.
It is not a nice review.
It is not.
And the important thing behind that is I am looking at, okay, are the people making this art trying to make art? Are they trying to make content? Or are they trying to make a sale? And those are really ever-shifting sliders. in every single capacity, because yeah, an indie actual play absolutely is trying to sell the indie game that they're playing because they're getting sponsored by it or they made it.
Sure, yeah, like, of course.
But that is so much different than Marvel making their TTRPG, hiring the Glass Cannon Network, who has their own problems of being anti-union, who has their own problems of like diversity in their casting, and then not utilizing the aesthetics of the art that they are supposedly making and not putting in the effort to even try to make it a piece of art.
Yeah.
Whereas with Faster Purple Worm, still made by a corporation made by Wizards of the Coast, who I am nowhere near friends with Wizards of the Coast. But what they're doing there is clearly they're trying to do something with the form. They are trying to use the medium of actual play to tell different kinds of stories. They're making episodic anthologies with a cool concept. There is effort that has been made to make this a real show. Maybe it doesn't have some huge social commentary. Maybe it's not critiquing the ways in which we engage with society, but it's still doing something cool and earnest and is not harming anyone as far as I'm aware.
Always an unfortunate good caveat.
And then you have like Harlem Hellfighters Never Die. You have this really indie show where when I was watching it, it has like 300 views or something like that, but it's getting nominated at all these web fests now. It is an incredible piece of art that is commenting on our society. It is a well-produced actual play with the minimal budget that it has. It's using visual elements. It's using sound elements. It is really trying to engage and make a piece of art. And even if it's not up to the quality of a Dimension 20, it is still worthy of note and attention.
Yeah, absolutely. I already feel like we're somehow pressed for time, which is the worst feeling in the history of the world. So this is already me hedging, saying like, well, I could have gone on this tangent, didn't even talk about this yet.
I've been rambling but so long. I want to make sure. I'm so sorry.
I mean, you should know better than anyone that everyone always assumes they've been rambling, and everyone assumes, oh, I've been talking and I'm sure none of it has made sense. And I am a big idiot who has just never shut up. And you know, that's literally never how it happens. And if it does happen, good news, we edit. And so it'll be fine. But I cannot end the conversation without talking a little bit about one of the pieces that I really enjoyed, which I think we've talked about a little bit, but more specifically about queer dungeons and transgender dragons.
Yes.
Exploring gender through imagined worlds, which again, there'll be a link to in the show notes. And it was it's a really lovely piece, and is certainly one that I know you got a lot of, you know, kind of attention for. People who are reading this after the fact will see a lot of former Reckless to Talk guests featured, which is very lovely because we happen to get a lot of very cool guests. For you as a journalist, as B, a journalist of a kind of niche art form, as a journalist of a niche art form that is filled with a lot of queer people and a lot of marginalized people trying to tell stories, trying to, you know, kind of show themselves represented in art and media, and as a, make sure I get all the points right, as a queer journalist reporting on et cetera, all those things, yourself, what was writing that story like, and getting to kind of like delve in and talk to all these other people about kind of their own experiences in sharing that? And in doing so, did you see that reflected at all in your own kind of relationship with tabletop role-playing games?
Absolutely. That Autostraddle piece you just mentioned is one of the pieces I'm proudest of writing, honestly. Writing that piece was very interesting for some behind the scenes, how the sausage is made. The reason why I got to write that article is because a friend of mine from stand-up comedy happens to work for them and was like, hey, you're a journalist, right? Do you want to pitch a piece to this editor? Because Autostraddle just got acquired by this company. And I was like, sure, absolutely. Networking. That's the only way it happens.
Yep. Only way.
And so I wrote this piece and I started writing it, and I had this really solid idea of kind of what we talked about, that the exploration, about being able to explore new ideas and safe containers. And then I had this really solid thought of wanting to have more voices than my own in this piece. I had written a piece for Autostraddle the year before in which I interviewed a bunch of trans stand-up comedians about what it is like being a trans stand-up comedian, what that experience is like, how comedy and being a public performer and having to engage with social media is so impactful for one's self-perception and the difficulty of trying to convey yourself to an audience when you and the audience are not on the same page about who you are. In tabletop role-playing games, you're never the person that you say you are. That's the whole thing, actually. Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
And so I reached out to Jay Dragon. I reached out to Connie Chung. I reached out to Dare Hickman. I reached out to Jay Stroutman. All of these incredible figures in the TTRPG actual play space, incredible queer figures, incredible trans figures, about how their relationship to gender impacts the way they play TTRPGs and the kind of art that they make. Mm-hmm. And I got like some of the standard answers of like, yeah, being able to play an elf helped me figure out my femininity. And then there was the brilliant responses from Jay and Connie about the radical ways exploring self creates new worlds. And I always learn something new when writing articles. Every single time I have to kind of become a mini expert on whatever the thing is I'm writing about. I was like, oh, tabletop games and transness. I am the expert. Yeah,
I got that. Well, so yeah, it's as locked down as it can be. Yeah.
And then Jay Dragon said something that will shock my brain for the rest of time. And that is something that is a fundamental truth of psychedelics as well. Another beat that I have been reporting on is that tabletop role-playing games themselves cannot change you. They can reinforce ideas that you have. They can change the ideas that you have, introduce you to new ones, allow you to engage with them. But them by themselves are not inherently going to make you a better or worse person. They're only going to emphasize the container and the presentation with which they have been given to you. And so to deconstruct that, Jay really blew my mind and was just like, you have to be so intentional about the way that you are presenting these things and the way that you are subtly influenced by the society that you exist within, because it's going to show up in the games that you play. And ever since then, having this understanding that TTRPGs aren't inherently good things, that, like I mentioned before, just like psychedelics will put you in any direction. If you are in any kind of container, you can have a great trip, you can have a bad trip. Set and setting is what it's all about. Knowing that, oh, these aren't just universally good things, shifted my brain to be like, oh, I have to look at these critically, because I could unintentionally be putting forth something that could be harmful, and uplifting that as like, oh, this is a great thing, like D&D had been doing for the last 50 years.
It's interesting that you mention about how it occurred to you to have different voices instead of just your own as a part of it.
Yeah.
And yet one of my favorite parts about the article was your kind of the preamble story about you and Max, who we've already name dropped in this conversation, kind of going through, starting, I think it was a full campaign, if I remember right off the top of my head, but yes, either starting a game, I think like what was the morning after his top surgery, I think, or something like that. And again, there's 15 million questions and prods and pokes that I'd love to do, which again is all well written in the article. Please go listen to it, dear listener. But I think where I kind of want to wrap things up for the conversation is reflecting back, and especially now that you are doing this as the thing you do, as you're in tabletop role-playing game, you know, in one way or other, has your own relationship to tabletop role-playing games, either as a scene, as a tool to create art, as art that you are consuming, or all of the above, how or has it impacted you? I guess just over the now many years, I think you've been running for close to a decade. You've been playing for even longer. What's just kind of your overall like core relationship, I guess, with tabletop role-playing games, and how has it affected you?
Tabletop role-playing games are probably the single strongest source of joy in my life. The ability to feel like I can make a difference, either in the world of the fiction or with the people that I am playing with, and provide them catharsis, escape, community. That has been life-changing. When I was talking about, like, yeah, the nerds, the just nerds, quote unquote, that I played D&D with first, all cis men, all cis teenage boys who don't know how to talk to each other.
Don't know how to talk.
Yeah.
You can even just leave it there, probably.
Yeah. But in those games, we were able to connect to each other. And then the most important parts of those games were not the games themselves, but the fact that we were all together. And then after the game was done for 2 hours, we would talk about the game and talk about our lives and talk about what's going on. And that sense of community is so important. And then moving into, like, actual play, getting to watch this medium develop and getting to watch people who have these beautiful ideals and these ways that they want to change the world get to have these platforms and share them with people. That agency that I think it has provided with me and that ability to feel like, oh, the individual grains of sand moving down the hourglass actually build up to a beach.
Yeah, I think that's a perfect way to put it. Brilliant word choice. And like I said, I have there's so many other things even just about that I want to talk about. And it's been such a lovely conversation. And therefore, I am loathe to bring it to a screeching and confrontational halt. Because, again, Rowan, this has been so wonderful and lovely, and you have been wonderful and lovely. But now, unfortunately, I have to break you. Spiritually speaking,
because it is, try your best.
It's time for, unfortunately for you, fortunately, I'm sure for the listener, for the Reckless to Talk lightning round.
All right.
And now I will give you the full disclaimer, legal disclaimer that I have to give everyone, that these are the same questions that we have asked every single guest who has ever been on this show in the exact same order. There are no wrong answers other than, I guess, lying, just because that's kind of a bummer. It can be a short little thing. It can be a long tangent. Oh, this reminds me of this time. It can be, you know, I don't have a good answer for that. All of them are valid. All will be quietly absorbed by me. And I will try so hard not to ask follow-up questions. I reserve the right if you say something fucking wild. But I will try my best to just let the answers stand. And then we'll go on to the next question. There's no time limit. And we'll get to what happens afterwards, should you make it there. Rowan, are you ready emotionally, spiritually, et cetera, for the lightning round?
Yeah, I'm ready.
You're not, but we'll start anyway. Question one. Is your glass half full or half empty?
About a quarter full.
Looking pointedly at her glass. What excites you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Watching people who are good at their craft get a space to do it well.
What does not excite you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Fascism.
I have no follow-up comments. What is your favorite sound?
My partner's laugh.
I'm not judging.
For the viewers, I cringed at myself for how wholesome it was.
Yep. I mean, that's unfortunately, this is a cringe forward podcast, and you know, we're not going to dissuade you from it. What sound do you hate?
Metal scraping along wood.
What is your favorite word?
Defenestration.
What is your least favorite word?
Thusly.
What tabletop role-playing game, or D&D, or whatever, monster or adversary, have you not faced or run that you would love to?
A beholder.
Very popular answer, and is one of my answers, absolutely. What is your favorite adventure of all time? And this can be an adventure, a TTRPG adventure you've read, that you've written, that you've run, that you've been a part of, that you have watched, or it could be 1999's The Mummy. Whatever the right answer is for you.
Balto?
Again, I have no follow-up questions to that. What is your favorite tabletop role-playing game character of all time? And again, it could be one of yours. It can be one of your friends. It could be an NPC. It could be someone you watched on a show, whatever that means to you.
Oh. Kumari, Chinook Tessera's character from My First Dungeon's Orbital Blues.
Oh. Rowan, last question. What gives you hope?
People. People give me hope. Seeing people come together, seeing people play games, seeing people make art, seeing people help each other and be in community, and seeing people go against the idea that they need to harm other people to be seen as good people.
Rowan, that brings us to the end of not just the Reckless Attack lightning round, but Reckless Attack itself. Congratulations for getting through the what I'm sure was very intense experience. Well done. As both congratulations and as a prize, please tell everyone who you have been, where they can find you, how to support you, what calls to action you may or may not have, et cetera, et cetera. Please.
I have been Rowan Zioli. Who knows who I'll be in the future? You can find me currently on social medias at Rowan Zioli on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. You can find Rascal News at Rascal_news on Twitter and Instagram, and at rascalnews.bluesky.social on Mastodon. I don't
know. we gotta say on your social medias of choices, go find it.
You can subscribe to us and support independent reader-funded journalism at rascal.news. You can subscribe to us at a bunch of different levels. We have free levels. We have $5, $12, higher levels than that if you got money and want to support us. And otherwise, I'm very excited to be in community with you.
Everyone, hey, everyone, go subscribe. Go either for free or for money. Go support community journalism. It's very important. Please go do that. And with that, goodbye!
Bye.